Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
You know, I've never given a way-seeking mind talk, so I guess this is it. So I'm 75 years old, and I've been coming to Canando for over 30 years. So, you know, you could be in for a long evening, except for the fact that old people forget a lot of stuff. So that should save you. Gosh, it's nice to see all these faces. Gosh, I know all of you except for Philip, but I feel like I know you because we've talked on email. You know, I really appreciate the Zooms during these COVID times have meant a lot to me. So thank you for everyone that's made that possible. And greetings from New Mexico. I'm in New Mexico now for the summer, but I will be back. Yeah, so I've been at Canando since 1991. And I feel deeply grateful to have found this practice because I think it's may have been the only path for me because I was such a skeptic about any kind of religion for as long as I can remember. You know, I think back to the second grade. I was six, almost 7 years old, and someone in the class revealed to us the secret that there was not really a Santa Claus, that it was our parents that brought the presents. And being the skeptic that I was kind of born as, I think, it was not a surprise to me. You know, I had had my doubts already. But I went home and asked my mom, and she seemed prepared for this question. And she said something like, "Oh, honey, Santa is the spirit of Christmas love." I said, "Okay, you know, that means you and Dad bring the presents, right?" And she admitted that that was true. But her description of Santa as Christmas love was very close to her description of God. She was always saying that God is love. So at age seven, almost seven, I determined, well, okay, Santa, the Easter Bunny, God, Jesus, the angels, the Tooth Fairy, these are all imaginary beings that for some reason adults want us to believe in. But they're not fooling me. Took me a few years to realize that a lot of adults believed in a few of those imaginary beings too. So that's a deeper mystery. But anyway, I was a skeptic early on. And even though we went to Sunday school and church, my parents were Presbyterians. So I went with them until I went off to college. But I was not a believer. And then once I was on my own, religion was not a part of my life. I don't think I ever had a kind of way-seeking mind. I was just a very comfortable and to be an agnostic. But I was very interested in philosophy and psychology. I was a psych major in college, and human motivation always interested me. And in high school and college, I read some of Alan Watts's books. And he was, I guess, a local guy. I mean, Les, did you know him? I think he lived in Mill Valley, and I think he knew Suzuki Roshi. He wrote a lot about Zen Buddhism. But if he had a meditation practice, he didn't write about it. Or I missed it. Anyway, I didn't realize there was a path. But I was taken by the philosophy, and the psychology of Buddhism felt true to me. So I was very interested in that, but I didn't know there were people meditating or sitting. So then in 1991, by then I was in my mid-40s. I was a single mom with two little kids. It was in the midst of another war. I mean, this Ukraine thing is so distressing. But that was distressing too. It was the first Gulf War. George Bush number one had invaded Iraq because Iraq had invaded the oil fields of Kuwait. And it was a very short war, fortunately, but it was distressing because people were watching it on TV like it was some sort of soccer tournament or something, and rah, rah, and isn't this great, you know, only 150 of our people died. They never mentioned the 50,000 Iraqis that we had killed. Anyways, it was distressing. And during this time, some friends of mine said, had been up to Green Gulch. And they said to me, you know, they had been up and heard a public lecture a few weekends before, and it was pretty weird, and they thought I would like it. So we went up, and it was Reb Anderson gave the talk, and he talked about peace and love, and all that was reassuring to me, you know, that not everyone was cheerleading this stupid war. I thought, oh, this is an interesting group of people, and this is a way that of practicing that I didn't know about. So I got the Tassajara brochure in the mail. This was before you signed up online. And I decided I'd explore this Zen stuff a little more. And there was an introductory to Zen workshop listed by this guy named Les Kay. And I saw that he was had a Zen center in Mountain View, which was not too far from me, because I lived in Los Altos, still do. And I thought, oh, well, I'll sign up. I'll go to this workshop. And if I like the guy, you know, he's nearby. I didn't know how nearby. You know, Les and I live about two blocks from each other, and did then too, but I didn't know that. So that summer I went to Tassajara to this workshop. It was a great workshop. Les is so good with beginners, and everyone in this group was a beginner, but he is so patient and kind and not condescending. I mean, he just has a way of meeting people where they are. And he had us make he brought clay with him, and he had us make the little pinch pots. I mean, did any of you do the pinch pot thing at Kanado recently? Anyway, he did this thing where we all made these pinch pots, and then put them aside. And then the next day he said, okay, everybody pass your pot to the person on the right. And we went, oh, no. We were very attached to our little pots. So that was a good lesson. I later tried that lesson with my kindergarten class, and it didn't go over well. They didn't want to pass their pots along either. But anyway, that was a great summer week at Tassajara with Les. And after that, I started going to Kanado, the old Kanado at College Avenue. So at that time, the custody arrangement with my ex-husband was that the kids were with him every other Wednesday and every other Saturday. So those were the times that I went to Kanado. And, you know, I was, I don't know, I guess everybody starts this way, but, you know, first I had 100 questions, but I was too shy and embarrassed to ask them. Jayashri said a few weeks back that she started with all these questions and then they kind of disappeared somehow. And that happened to me too. I also remember sitting there for weeks thinking, what am I doing here? You know, I should be doing this and that. This is a waste of time. My mind's all over the place. This is not working. I think maybe I'll just leave early. Then I think, no, I'll stick it out, but I'm not coming back. You know, this is it for me. And then, you know, a couple of weeks later, I'd be back. And that went on and on until finally I had to admit to myself that I could stop pretending that I was not coming back, that for whatever reason that I didn't understand, I was here. And I thought about that a lot, why it stuck with me when I was such a skeptic, even though the teaching seemed real. I finally decided it was the Sangha. You know, Vanessa was talking a couple of weeks back about friendship and the importance of Sangha. And that was a surprise to me, because I thought of it, Zazen, as a solitary practice, and that I was a solitary person. So perfect, you know, perfect. But yeah, I think it's the people, it's the family that brought me back and back and back and has been so important to me for 30 years. So here in New Mexico, we have a little sitting group. We sit once a week for 40 minutes, and there's no teaching, no Dharma talks, no chanting, no ceremony. But it's still a Sangha. You know, it still works somehow. So I'm very grateful for this little sangha too. So I'd like to tell a little story about Les K, because I think I'm the only person who witnessed this. And it made a big impact on me. This was many years ago at the College Avenue Zendo. And for many months, this young man came on Wednesday nights. I don't know what his diagnosis was, but he clearly had some sort of mental illness. And one of his symptoms was that he couldn't sit still, which is pretty hard, you know, for somebody trying to practice zazen. And he would sit there and move and move. And it must have been in the winter, because he had on this, he would wear this ski parka. Remember those old ski parkas that made a lot of noise when you moved? I don't know, they were crinkly somehow. So not only was he wiggly, but he was noisy. And he would sit near the door, and sometimes he would even leave before the 40 minutes was up. And people tended not to sit near him because he was distracting. Well, I don't mind that kind of distraction. Actually, I kind of like it, because it's better than, you know, the monkey mind distractions that I have. So I was sitting right behind him. So this guy is on the tan in front of me, and I'm on the floor sitting behind him. This is Wednesday night. And I noticed that Les has gotten up from his cushion and is walking around the room. Now, that was unusual for Wednesday. I mean, sometimes during Sesshin, he would do that and maybe correct people's posture, but not on Wednesday nights. So this was unusual. And I thought, aha, I know what he's doing. He's going to walk around, straighten up a few other people, and then he's going to come to this guy and try to fix him. And sure enough, Les started around the room, and he would tap people on the shoulder and ask whether it would be all right if he corrected their posture. Of course, no one ever said no, I'm sure. So he stopped at one person and then went around another. I thought, okay, here he comes. He's going to come to this guy. And he does. He comes up to this wiggly person who is by this time totally slumped over in a way that, you know, no wonder he can't keep the still. It just was a terrible posture. And so he taps the guy on the shoulder, and I kind of prick up my ears to listen. And Les whispers to him, "You're doing just fine." And I don't know, it just pierced my heart, you know, to hear that. It was such a sweet lesson for me. I know, I think I probably sat there and cried for the rest of the 40 minutes, but I'm a crier. You know, just meet people where they are. I mean, that's one of the many great lessons that I've learned from Les. So thank you, Les. I could go on and on, but I'd love to hear from anyone in this room. Diane.
Thank you for your talk, Janet. I didn't realize you've never given away Seeking Mind talk. And we've been together for many years. That was a touching story about Les. I had no idea what you were going to say when he finally came to that individual. And someone like that can be so distracting, and I think I would be judging him and be annoyed with him, and instead Les welcomed him, and it is a nice lesson. You mentioned your group that you sit with and how important Sangha is and how we're a family. And I have a similar background as yours in that I'm a cynic and a skeptical person, but I think because I grew up with ritual, I like the ritual that we have in our practice, as well as sitting with other people and sharing and talking. And you seem to be fine with your group that, you know, just sits, you don't chant and you don't have any ritual. How do you feel about ritual in our practice?
I really like the Zen rituals. The reason in our little group that we don't have Dharma talks or rituals is that we are so diverse. I mean, there's one guy in our group that talks to aliens on another planet.
Oh.
You know, it's almost better that we don't talk because, yeah, I thought California was a woo-woo place. New Mexico is more woo-woo than California. So it's just nice to sit together in silence. But yeah. No, I wouldn't have thought I was a ritual lover, but you know, I just find the Zen rituals comforting. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to think that all around the world people are doing the same mm-hmm. thing. Like, I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Diane. I love you. We've been together a long time. You know, the other person, I don't see Eric Geist. I don't see your face at the moment. But I just like to say, Eric, I don't know, has it been 20 years since the Noon Zazen group started? At one point, because I don't show up at 5:30 in the morning, but I thought, you know, the Zendo's empty all day. Why not have a noon group? So I started that. I don't know how many years ago, but within a year, maybe Eric and Steve took it over. And all these years he's been the head of the Noon Zazen group. So thank you, Eric. And I hope that can start up again. Is there a plan for that?
I unfortunately can't do it right now. Hopefully, we'll have to see how the pandemic goes and just my situation here at home. But thank you for that. So we had a lot of people come through. I keep remembering all the people that came through, Vanya and, Joan Albert and everybody else. So really good memories.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
David.
Thank you for your talk. Very personal, very heartfelt. Eric just mentioned people coming through. And I am one who kind of came through Kanando and then orbited off. How has the flow of constantly different people interacted with your sense of sangha and community? How do you find continuity or disruption in what sustains you, but at the same time is often rather turbulent?
Well, there's less. but there are also many people that, I mean, Dave Riddell, Brenda, Dan, I mean, Diane. There's a lot of continuity, even with the changes. And I don't know, just the place. I just, I'm really quite attached to Rock Street. yeah. And David, it's been really nice on Zoom to see you again. I remember you from the old days on college. Yeah, it's really, this is a great thing about Zoom, I think, to be connected again. Yeah, thank you. And it's been great to see your face these last few months. Dave?
Thank you so much, Janet, for your heartfelt talk. I certainly found a lot of your points resonating a lot with my own experience and feelings, especially the inability to really latch on to all of those, the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and all the other wonderful deities. You mentioned about the variety of thought in the Southwest. I remember years ago, Suzanne and I went to Sedona, and we were absolutely blown away by the beauty of the place. And then we came back to our motel that night, and we were watching the local TV station, and they had a very detailed, energetic debate going on this local TV channel. Two people debating all the details of the Age of Aquarius. And I had a little trouble taking that very seriously. One of the questions in my mind, you mentioned about, your own feeling of skepticism, and I certainly identify with that. But there are sort of two arguments that you commonly hear for religion with a capital R. One is that it helps people feel better in the sense that they feel that they understand their world. The world makes more sense to them. And I have a lot of trouble with the idea that something that makes so little sense to me would be so helpful to other people. But, people are different. But the other argument is that religion makes people behave themselves. And I'm not so sure about that. I'm just curious what your feeling is about that completely separate argument to try to justify more traditional religions that the phrase God-fearing, right? He's a good person because he's a God-fearing person. What do you think about that effect of religion on people's behavior and on helping society function smoothly?
Yeah, good question. I mean, that was my initial explanation to myself when I was 7 years old, that why did adults want us to believe in these imaginary beings? It's so that we would behave ourselves, you know? Well, I am so skeptical about religion that I guess I'm skeptical about that part too, that that's necessary for us to behave ourselves. I think we have other motivations for good or bad behavior other than religion. You know, I don't even like the word spiritual. I mean, this is how skeptical I am. I think spiritual implies, you know, something otherworldly or outside of our reality, whereas I think of our practice and Buddhism as reality, just a bigger reality, you know, and that there's no need to call it spiritual. It's just a larger view, you know, big mind. So yeah, I think people either born skeptics or born believers. I really think that. And man, I'm, you know, on that spectrum, I'm way on the skeptic side. And I think you too are, Dave Riddell.
Yeah, I heard an interesting sort of bottom line condensation the other day about confirmation bias. You know, there's the old thing about people from Missouri, you know, I'll believe it when I see it.
Right.
And with confirmation bias, it's really the other way around. It's I'll see it when I believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I lived in Missouri for a while, so I am one of those show me people too. Yeah. So Dave, I've enjoyed practicing with you all these years, and I really appreciate your contribution to Kanendo.
Well, when I first arrived, you were one of the stalwarts and I was one of the newcomers, but I guess now I'm not a newcomer anymore.
No. So when did you come?
It's just about exactly 20 years ago.
Okay. So we were still on College Avenue, though.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was 7 years before Rock Street, maybe 4 or 5 years before Rock Street was completed.
Yeah. So, Dan, you were on College, right?
I was not. No, I had little note, maybe 2008.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's a big shout out, though.
Oh. Well, someday we're going to have to hear all of Philip's stories about haiku zendo. I really want to hear those. There's a little haiku zendo booklet. I don't know if you have it, of the history of haiku zendo. And I looked in there, and sure enough, there was a Phil Olson contribution in there. You know what I'm talking about? Like, we can't hear you because you're muted. You have to unmute yourself.
The book that Barbara Heaston edited and put together, right?
I don't know who did it, but it's just a little, yeah, haiku zendo book. Yeah.
Well, of course, the other thing, Janet, from haiku zendo that's so wonderful is the sign in the Dokusan room. Most everybody, I think, has seen it, but I'm not sure everybody understands where it came from. The carved wooden sign on the wall of the Dokusan room says haiku zendo in kanji, and it's calligraphy by Suzuki Roshi, which he then sent to Japan, and a master woodcarver in Japan carved it into that wonderful piece of wood and sent it back.
Oh, I never knew what that was. Thanks, Dave. Thank you, Giuseppe and Teresa, whatever time it is in Europe. Thanks for zooming in. Love you guys.
Thank you. Janet, I wanted to ask you one thing. When I last visited, we spent a wonderful time, little time, with Cornelia that you invited over. And I was really struck by that little meeting we had with her and you. she's not, she has retired from her sangha, from leading her sangha in San Jose after so many years. And she seems to be very much at peace, even without practicing actively with the sangha. And that left me with a big impression about that. Now, in your talk, you're stressing the importance of practicing with the sangha. And that surprised me, because I thought that you also felt that one could be at peace without even the work of keeping an ongoing sangha with all the practicalities and things going on. So what was your feeling from that meeting with Cornelia that day, and on this topic of finding peace in practice?
You know, I think after so many years of practice, I don't want to say that Zazen doesn't matter, because I think for a lot of people it's still very important, but Zazen, Sangha, it all just seeps into you. And to me, even when I'm not with the Sangha, I still am with the Sangha. You know, it's all so much a part of me now. And I can't explain how that happened, but it's been a wonderful comfort in my life. Because I was such a loner. And now I don't feel alone. I mean, thank you all for that. We miss you, Giuseppe. It was great to see you.
Yeah, it was great to be together. I'll be back.
Great. So Dan, are we done?
Does anyone else have any questions? Thoughts? It's a great talk. It's nice to, Jan, I don't know you that well, so it is nice to hear you talk about these items. And I just have to say, when I was going to introduce you, I wanted to use the word straightforward person, but I didn't know how that would come off. Is that a good thing, a bad thing? And Philip said, mentioned direct, you know, and I think direct though in a, I don't know, a kind way, it's good. So anyway, it struck me that we had similar impressions, even though we may know you in different ways.
Somewhere on the spectrum.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.